currently hearing Paul Kalkbrenner with the tune Cody 3000 from The Essence. Before this, we had Anzola and the tune Cinco Bets from Bodega. I'm DJ Firefly. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. That's about it for me for this show. If you missed the show or you want to get in touch with me, my website is at djfirefly.com.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Northwestern Law School professor Heidi Kittrosser about Northwestern's capitulation to the Trump administration in a recent wide-ranging settlement agreement.
Professor Kittrosser explains how the settlement violates the First Amendment rights of students and faculty at Northwestern.
Then, continuing the theme of violations of constitutional rights, we'll also talk with Dario Sanchez, one of the defendants in what the government has labeled the first Antifa terrorism prosecution.
A computer science teacher, Dario was arrested in a pre-dawn raid, and along with several others, now faces terrorism-related charges stemming from a July 4th protest. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. The day after Thanksgiving last year, in an undeserved win for Donald Trump and a sad loss for higher education, Northwestern University joined Columbia and Brown Universities by capitulating to Trump's year-long campaign to bribe American colleges and universities into paying ransom to restore millions of dollars of federal research grants he had illegally suspended on the pretext that the universities had failed to adequately monitor anti-Semitism on their campuses. Northwestern agreed to pay the Trump administration $75 million and enter into a three-year settlement agreement containing a host of provisions seriously impairing Northwestern's educational independence and academic freedom. Within days of the settlement, two law professors from Northwestern's own law school, Heidi Kittrosser and Paul Gowder, went public alleging that the settlement agreement was illegal and unconstitutional. They wrote, quote, "Our analysis lays bare that the government's extortion of Northwestern, unlawfully freezing funds to force the university to make a deal, has nothing to do with actual legal violations at Northwestern, which, if they existed, could and should have been addressed through established legal channels, and everything to do with a campaign to encroach on the autonomy of Northwestern and other institutions of higher education, and to impose on them the Trump administration's reactionary political agenda," unquote. Today at Law and Disorder, we're very pleased to be joined by Heidi Kittrosser. She's the William W. Gurley Professor of Law at Northwestern's Pritzker School of Law. She's an expert on constitutional law, government secrecy, and free speech law. Her book, Reclaiming Accountability, Transparency, Executive Power, and the U.S. Constitution, was awarded the 2014 IIT Chicago-Kent School of Law Roy C. Palmer Civil Liberties Prize. She is a 2017 recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship. Professor Kittrosser has been involved in drafting several amicus briefs in recent years challenging threats to free speech, academic freedom, and government accountability. She's also a founding steering committee member of the Free Expression Legal Network. FELN is a network of law school clinics, academics, and practitioners, including nonprofits, across the country that seeks to promote and protect free speech, free press, and the flow of information. Professor Kittrosser, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here, and I really appreciate you covering these important issues.
Well, this controversy began in April of 2025 when the Trump administration froze $790 million allocated to Northwestern researchers. You've written that that freeze violated federal law. Please explain why.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should start by saying the freeze, in my view, was so wildly illegal that it was endlessly frustrating to me that the university did not see fit to follow Harvard's lead and sue the administration for their lawless activity, let alone to go ahead and settle as they did. But in terms of the illegality of the freeze itself, I guess the most important point to make at the outset, and I think it's a point that understandably a lot of lay people don't sort of intuitively sort of come in knowing, and that is receiving federal funding from the government does not mean that a university or any other institution that may receive federal funding is completely beholden to whatever the federal government wants to make them do. I have seen from time to time, for example, in comment sections, which I think can be illuminating as to what folks tend to think about things, I have seen from time to time comments with folks saying in relation to stories about Northwestern or other schools, well, it's the government's funding. They can do whatever they want with it. That's actually not accurate. There are very important constitutional and statutory limits on the way that the government can leverage their funds. And there's a very, very good reason for that. When a school receives funding, it's not something that the federal government is doing simply out of the goodness of their heart as a favor to the institution. They're doing it because legislation through democratically elected legislatures, et cetera, evinces a consensus that it is for the good of society as a whole. We provide some funding to assist in scientific research, in historical research, in helping students get good educations, et cetera. But that funding would be much less helpful and much less meaningful for society if it were politicized, if it came with strings attached saying, by the way, you can't use this funding to do anything that might upset the current occupant in the White House. So that's why it's very important that federal funding not be able to be used as political tools of leverage. And in fact, there are important legal limits on how federal funding can be utilized. So for one thing, when federal funds are given to institutions such as universities to pursue research, to aid students, or things of that nature, one very clear limit established over many cases, over many years in the Supreme Court and in other courts, is that the government may not make the funding contingent on whether or not they agree or disagree with the viewpoints that the funding is being, that the funding recipients are expressing. Another very important limit is that if Congress establishes statutory guidelines as to how funds can be allocated or restricted, the executive is obligated constitutionally to follow the law and can't just ignore those guidelines. So in this case, there are at least two very significant types of legal violations that were afoot with the freezing of $790 million in funding. One was a problem under the First Amendment, and that is even though the federal government didn't really articulate a clear rationale as to why they were withholding the funding, many of their statements, including public statements that they made, suggested that they were doing so in part out of disgust with, you know, so-called wokeness that they perceive to exist at Northwestern. And there are many, many examples one can find of statements to this effect, statements indicating that they didn't like the way Northwestern or other universities the way individual professors might have talked about certain issues in the news or might have talked about gender, et cetera. Now, to the extent that this was retaliation because they didn't like the viewpoints expressed by members of the campus community, that runs afoul of the First Amendment. That's not a valid basis constitutionally for restricting federal funds. Another and perhaps much more obvious violation was that they did not adhere to whatever statutory guidelines might pertain were they to decide to freeze or to take away federal funding. So again, the government did not offer any sort of coherent, certainly any written rationale or give any written demands as to why they were withdrawing the funding. But apart from their general gripes about supposed wokeness at universities, the other rationale that was suggested in some informal statements of theirs that floated around in the press was that they were retaliating against alleged anti-Semitism at Northwestern, which could amount to violations under a statute called Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. However, it's very clear under Title VI that a president or an agency head can't just themselves decide willy-nilly, gosh, it looks to me like there's anti-Semitism or some other problem, and I'm going to unilaterally yank the funds. There are very clear procedural requirements. There has to be notice given to the university. There has to be an opportunity for the university to find out what the supposed violations were, to contest it. There even has to be notice given to members of Congress. None of that was followed. The university just yanked the funds. So it was an arbitrary yanking of funds, which also based on a number of public statements smacked of viewpoint discrimination. So at minimum, there were First Amendment problems and a complete failure to adhere to statutory guidelines, even if the federal government really did have concerns about possible violations of federal civil rights law.
Professor, you've written that the settlement agreement between Trump and Northwestern violates the First Amendment in several ways. Please explain why you've reached that conclusion.
Absolutely. So, first of all, perhaps the most fundamental problem that the settlement poses under the First Amendment is that Northwestern entered into it at the metaphorical barrel of a gun. So, and here's why that's important. Northwestern's actions, in this case, entering into the settlement agreement, are due to coercion by the federal government. Then the actions essentially are attributable to the federal government, which means the federal government essentially is the actor here because they coerced Northwestern into entering into this agreement. And so the terms of the agreement suddenly become subject to the First Amendment. In this case, and the Supreme Court has said, they said very recently in a unanimous decision in a case called NRA versus Vulo in just 2024, I believe it was, this kind of coercion occurs effectively when a reasonable person would understand that there is a reasonable threat of adverse action. In this case, that threat is absolutely present. In fact, it goes beyond a threat. In this case, the federal government had arbitrarily yanked $790 million in funding away from Northwestern. The obvious threat was, A, that the money wouldn't be put back in Northwestern's coffers where it belonged, and B, that further financial repercussions and possibly other regulatory repercussions would occur. So the agreement really is attributable to the federal government, which means it comes under the auspices of the First Amendment. From that perspective, one and probably the most fundamental First Amendment problem is the government is going well beyond whatever the contours of the funding programs at issue are to try to control the speech of students, faculty, staff more broadly.
Professor, you've also written that Northwestern, quote, agreed to several provisions that explicitly contradict current Supreme Court interpretation of anti-discrimination law and executive power. Please explain how Northwestern agreed to things that went beyond what is legally required under existing federal law.
What I mean by that, I said a few minutes ago in response to the first question, federal funds are not constitutionally, they are not a tool and are not allowed to be used as a tool to control anything that a funding recipient says and does. There are limits on the way the government can use it as leverage to coerce other people's speech. Perhaps the most important limit is that the government cannot say, well, I'm funding X program, this specific program, this type of research, and therefore I'm going to control other things you say and do outside the program. The agreement absolutely does that. To the extent that, for example, the federal government funds scientific research, that does not give the government carte blanche to control all aspects, for example, of hiring or of protests that might occur at the university in which students engage. So perhaps the most fundamental First Amendment problem is that it leverages the government's participation in funding specific programs into an ability to monitor and control all kinds of speech around the university and around campus life that have nothing to do with the funding. Another very significant problem is the nature of some of the speech-based requirements that are included in the agreement. So perhaps the most obvious ones involve student protests. So the issue here, and this is a little bit complicated, but the issue here is that back in, I believe it was the spring or sometime in the last year or two, Northwestern reworked its own rules for free speech on campus and for speech that can happen in the midst of campus protests. Some of them, I think, are somewhat vague and overbroad. Now, Northwestern, again, is a private institution. If it were voluntarily instituting those kinds of requirements, you know, that would not be a constitutional problem. But the federal government included in this agreement a requirement that Northwestern not change its rules unless it first notifies the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. So it's now the federal government essentially locking in and overseeing the way that students can engage in speech and protest, including through the use of some rules that I think are somewhat vague and overbroad. And the final thing I'd say here, there's a lot more that can be said, but I'll just give one more example. The agreement, the university was, in my view, very much coerced into entering into, the agreement also massively restricts the extent to which the university can consider or solicit from applicants for admission or from students in various capacities certain types of speech. In particular, it limits the extent to which the university, for example, can consider essays that talk about an applicant's experiences in life that have something to do with their race, because it suggests that the institution may not use race as a proxy in any way, in hiring, in admissions, etc. This goes well beyond what the Supreme Court has said about affirmative action. The Supreme Court, although it's heavily restricted the use of race as a consideration in admissions by institutions that get Title VI funding, the Supreme Court made a point of saying, however, that does not stop an institution from considering an applicant's discussion of the way race had an impact on them personally and on their own life experience and on comprising the person overall that they are today. The agreement would bar consideration of that kind of speech. So in addition to going well beyond what the Supreme Court has said about race, it also limits the university's academic freedom to determine how it's going to choose its student body.
If you just joined us, this is Law and Disorder. I'm co-host Stephen Rohde, and I'm joined by my colleague Heidi Boghossian. We're speaking to Professor Heidi Kittrosser of the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law on the recent settlement between Northwestern University and the Trump administration.
Professor, in a particularly appalling provision, Northwestern agreed to, quote, terminate the Deering Meadow Agreement of April 29, 2024, and reverse all the policies that had been implemented or are being implemented in adherence to it, end quote. Tell us about the Deering Meadow Agreement and how the repudiation of that agreement undermines the university's commitment to protect the rights of Muslim and Arab students.
Yeah, so I think the most important point to be made about the provision that revokes the Deering Meadow Agreement is that whatever one thought about, you know, the specifics or specific provisions of the Deering Meadow Agreement, it is not the business of the federal government the way Northwestern's administration chose to negotiate with student protesters. And I think that's the real key here, because, you know, there were differences of opinion about the agreement. But I think regardless of where someone came down on the agreement itself, I would hope that we could all agree the solution to negotiating over differences of opinion about agreement is not to bring in the federal government and invite a federal government takeover. I would also come back to sort of the fundamental point that I mentioned before about the limits of the power that the law quite rightly attaches to federal funding. Funding certain programs, it does not give the federal government carte blanche to dictate every aspect of a university's speech, of a campus community speech, of its relationship with and among its students and faculty. So that's the real problem here. As to the agreement itself, I mean, the agreement, I would invite people to look at it, although I could add it's very hard to find, because in one particularly chilling aspect of the aftermath of the agreement between Northwestern and the federal government, the agreement has largely been memory-holed. In fact, I was looking to Google it just to refresh my memory for this conversation, and I had a lot of difficulty finding it. I ultimately had to find a link on the Internet's Wayback Machine. So that's rather Orwellian, in my view, the fact that it's even difficult to find the agreement. And again, this is at the heavy hand of the federal government. But I would encourage folks to go to the Wayback Machine or, you know, email people if you have friends who have old agreements and look at it, because it's a relatively short, pretty unobtrusive agreement. Probably about half of it concerned restrictions and rules on protests for the remainder of that particular school year, which was 2024. There is also information about restarting an advisory committee, I'm forgetting the exact name of it, but some sort of advisory committee comprised of students and I believe other university stakeholders over university investments. There were also a couple of provisions regarding the creation of, I believe it was some sort of hangout location or house for Arab and Muslim students, in the same way that similar facilities existed on campus for Jewish students and for other groups of students. And so, in my own view, it was a perfectly reasonable agreement that attempted to take into consideration the interests and the learning experiences of Jewish and Muslim and Arab students alike. I do think there were some reasonable disagreements among members of campus about the specifics of the Deering Meadow Agreement, and I would hate for any disagreements about this or that provision to become distractions from the larger issue that I think is most important when we're talking about this agreement between Northwestern and the federal government, which is it is not the federal government's business. The nuance is of campus protest rules or of agreements that the university made with its students.
Professor, as we come to a close, you have written and said in this interview that Northwestern would have been on strong footing to have sued the university. Tell us briefly about the other cases that have succeeded in that regard.
Yeah, so, and I wrote an op-ed for the Daily Northwestern in which I indeed cited these other cases, which I think we should have followed as models. So Harvard, as a university, sued the federal government. In addition, there was suit brought by some individual stakeholders at Harvard, I believe, including the Harvard AAUP. And then there was a suit coming from the University of California. The institution itself did not sue, but there were two suits, one brought by the University of California, AAUP, and I believe possibly a couple of other organizations, and then a separate suit brought as a class action by individual faculty from different parts of the University of California system who had lost grants. Both of those lawsuits at this point in the litigation have been successful. They both got very strong opinions from the respective district court judges. In both cases, the district court judges said that the withholding of funds violated the First Amendment, essentially for reasons very similar to what I said at the start of this discussion when I talked about why the initial freezing of funds at Northwestern violated the First Amendment. In both of those cases, the judges made very strong statements to the effect that the record, including numerous statements made by the federal government as to why they were revoking the funds, reflected hostility to various viewpoints that the federal government attributed to the university, and that amounted to a First Amendment violation because it conditioned funds on agreement with viewpoint. One thing I should add there is that there's one difference with Northwestern, and I addressed this in that op-ed that I just mentioned, and that is in Northwestern's case, in many ways, our freezing of funds was actually much more arbitrary than existed in those other cases because the federal government never gave us any formal notice. And I have heard some people say, well, that would have made it harder to sue because you don't have a viewpoint-based statement from the federal government you could point to. In my view, and as I discussed in that op-ed, I actually think that doesn't weaken our case at all because I think there's plenty of information out there in terms of federal government statements that indicate that this really was viewpoint-based. Furthermore, it simply can't be the case that the federal government can simply get around First Amendment limits by yanking money away without formally giving a rationale. The other thing that happened in the, I believe this was the Boston case, the Judge Burroughs in the Massachusetts District Court, Federal District Court, also said the federal government had violated Title VI, using exactly the kind of rationale I talked about at the beginning of the discussion as well. She said there are important procedural requirements that the federal government has to follow if they want to remove funds on the basis of Title VI violations, including allegations of anti-Semitism, and they were not followed here. You know, as I've indicated just now and at the start of the discussion, I think we had every bit as strong a case, if not in some ways stronger. I think it's a real shame that we didn't stand up to the Trump administration in the face of lawless action and sue them.
Professor, as we draw to a close, what are the prospects that the Northwestern settlement will be challenged in court? And what do you think are the chances that some or all of it will ultimately be set aside by the conservative Supreme Court?
As to, you know, whether suit will be brought, I just don't know. You know, we'll have to wait and see. You know, I think that's something a number of people are thinking about, but we'll just have to keep our eyes peeled. I do think that there would be a very good case on the merits for the reasons that I detailed before as to why I think that this agreement can really be attributed to the federal government because of coercion and thus raises significant First Amendment problems as well as, you know, some other legal problems as well, but at minimum raises important First Amendment problems. I think that one hurdle, but I do not think it is by any means intractable. I do think that one thing that I imagine any lawyers who are looking into this are going to think about is there is a question of who will have standing here. Now, I do not think by any means that is anywhere close to insurmountable because there's no question that the agreement will affect and probably already is affecting students, sort of a range of stakeholders, including students whose interest in protest, in public discussion of ideas on controversial issues certainly will be impacted, probably already are being impacted, among other things, by the protest rules I mentioned. There also, I think, for a number of reasons, probably already is and certainly will be an impact on faculty, among other things, faculty who, for example, teach courses about the history of the Middle East. And so it's going to be a matter, if there is a lawsuit, you know, the right plaintiffs who can say quite reasonably that they're directly affected by this, deciding to bring suit. I wouldn't be surprised, and here I am purely speculating, I have no inside knowledge of this, I wouldn't be surprised if it takes a little while because I think lawyers quite reasonably, if they are looking at this, you know, would want to be able to gather some sort of on the ground examples and evidence of ways in which the agreement, both on its face, but also in application, is impacting people and their ability to teach and their ability to speak out as students, et cetera. as to, you know, if a case like this were ever to reach the Supreme Court, and it's not clear that it would, because the Supreme Court, of course, has a lot of discretion in which cases it hears, so it's not clear to me that it would necessarily want to take this case if it were to be brought and to wind up all the way on petition for certiorari to the Supreme Court. If they were to take it, I don't think it's at all a foregone conclusion how they would rule. There are many respects in which this is a very conservative court. I think that they have, I've been pretty outspoken about the fact that I think they have been overly credulous in the representations of this administration, particularly in the context of their shadow docket. That said, this is a court that in a number of decisions has suggested it takes a favorable view of the importance of First Amendment rights. So I don't think it's a foregone conclusion what they would do depending on what issues and what form any case ended up taking.
Professor Heidi Kittrosser, we are so grateful for what you're doing on the ground and in your courage as a Northwestern professor for speaking up. Thank you very much for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, and thank you again for covering this important topic.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
On July 4th, a small group of people gathered in front of the Prairieland Detention Center in Alvarado, Texas. They were protesting in solidarity with immigrants and ICE detainees, using noise and fireworks, ordinary tools on Independence Day. Police later claimed that an Alvarado officer was involved in an exchange of gunfire after arriving near the protest, sustaining minor injuries. 6 months later, the authorities have still not produced hospital records substantiating those claims. Despite that, a federal grand jury in Fort Worth indicted 9 people in connection with the July protest. 7 others were charged separately. Charges include rioting, use of weapons and explosives, obstruction, providing material support to terrorists, and attempted murder of an Alvarado police officer and unarmed correctional officers. The Trump administration has publicly framed the Prairieland case as the first prosecution of Antifa. On September 25th, the White House issued a directive ordering federal law enforcement to prioritize so-called Antifa-linked activity as domestic terrorism. Kash Patel has echoed that framing, publicly labeling the defendants Antifa-aligned anarchist violent extremists. Joining us to talk about this case is Dario Sanchez, one of the defendants. A computer science teacher, Dario is caretaking for his injured partner since 2024. He was arrested at a pre-dawn raid on their home with no resistance. Dario, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, good to be here.
We're so grateful you can join us today. Why don't we begin with the circumstances of your arrest and any pretrial conditions that you're bound by?
Sure. So I was arrested July 15th. Basically, at the crack of dawn, the FBI came over a loudspeaker and said that I was to come out by name. And before I could finish getting dressed, they started bashing down my door using an armored vehicle. And they had sent a drone into the living room to watch us as me and my girlfriend came out. Then they handcuffed us and went into the house. They threw a flashbang into one of the rooms and into the shed out back. And it's a pretty jarring experience, I'll say that. As for the bond conditions, so I have an ankle monitor on. My phone is being monitored for anything, quote, relating to gun violence, anti-government, or violence in general. And I actually had a new one added recently because basically I went to a hearing of another defendant. And at that hearing, the prosecution decided to call me up to the witness stand all of a sudden. and then basically threatened me for being at that hearing, saying it was somehow a violation of my bond conditions. So after the fact, they added that I can't speak to any co-defendants.
And just to clarify, what were you charged with?
I was charged with tampering with physical evidence, and then later I was indicted for hindering the prosecution of terrorism.
In the aftermath of July 4, what did you learn about the protests and the arrests that were going on?
I went to bed pretty early, so when I woke up, I just saw a bunch of messages about people having been arrested, and I figured, well, it's just, you know, your average protest thing, and I figured, well, this is unfortunate, but, you know, we'll just have to figure it out. Maybe some people need bail money. And then, of course, it turned out that that wasn't the case, that things were a lot more out of the ordinary. So, yeah, mainly for the first few days until my arrest, all that I learned was that was what was coming out on the news, you know, something about a shooting, that somebody was on the run. I really knew as much as everybody else at that point.
So let's go back to the details of your arrest, if you don't mind, because you were arrested a total of three times. Exactly what were the facts related to that first arrest?
So that first arrest was apparently because Song, the person who's alleged to have been on the run, their roommate, Thomas, ended up coming over to my house after the FBI raided their apartment and just told me what happened, right? Told me that my apartment's been raided, all of my devices have been seized, and let me know that any group chats and other things that they were in, they should probably be taken off of them, right? Their access should be revoked. I figured that's a pretty reasonable request. You don't have access to your devices, so I let people know. And we were in our local SRA chapter together, the Socialist Rifle Association. And so I removed Thomas from a chapter Discord server that just talks about, well, chapter business, right? So yes, basically because I removed someone from a Discord server, I was charged with tampering with physical evidence, and they decided to execute a no-knock raid on my house because of it.
Now, I understand that, was it your second unexpected arrest where you witnessed rather disturbing abuse of another prisoner? And if so, what did you see and what were you charged with?
Yes, so that happened after I was released from jail the first time. I had been in solitary for almost 40 days, and a week after, there was a bond conditions hearing scheduled, and my lawyer told me, this is pretty routine, you know, we can go and negotiate, and we'll figure it out. So we went, and the first thing they said when they started talking about my case was that I had been indicted on an additional charge. So that was a total surprise to me and my lawyer, and he suddenly had to negotiate a change to my bond amount and also negotiate these bond conditions. So in the end, I was arrested in court and taken to jail, and I waited about 6 days before I could get out because my girlfriend had to figure out how to schedule the ankle monitor company to come out and put one on me. So while I was in booking that second time, you know, I noticed that there was someone screaming in one of the, what I later learned was a suicide watch cell. At first it was, you know, intermittent, but then it got more and more, and I heard this guy screaming for his parents, for a doctor, and I just noticed that the guards watching him were just extremely callous towards him, and some of them were even mocking him. And later, when I went out for a phone call, I saw one of the guards, you know, spark his taser under a desk, right, while looking at another guard and, you know, motioning towards the cell of that other man as a sort of joke. And this went on and on for hours, right? I heard him slamming his body against the inside of that cell and felt it shake the walls of my cell. And then eventually, another guard came to some sort of agreement with him to where if they put him with other people, that he would calm down. So they placed him in my holding cell with me and some other guys, and well, at that point I kind of had to take it upon myself to calm him down, because immediately the other guards were threatening him with putting him back in that cell again, and were just making things worse, right? They were saying, oh, well, if you can't calm down, then, you know, we're going to put you back in there, as if he, just not even giving him time to come down from that. There's one thing about that second arrest that I do feel I should add. When I actually met this guy who had been stuck in that suicide watch cell, it became very clear that he had some kind of developmental disability and did not fully understand why he was in jail. That kind of made all of what I had seen done to him just all the more worse, right? Like, the callousness of the guards, the joking about harming him, I don't know. It's something that when I was eventually put in general population after being processed in booking, other inmates came up to me and just kind of could see that I was visibly not okay from having seen that.
And Dario, then weeks after you were released on bond, prosecutors arrested you a third time at gunpoint. They alleged that you were searching for information on explosive devices, but in reality, it was your bond officer who had made those searches. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was just one of the strangest things I've ever experienced, where I had been called in for a random drug test, another of my bond conditions. So I have to drive more than an hour to Johnson County from my home in order to do this. So about halfway there, a bunch of unmarked police cars surround me at an intersection. Guns are drawn on me, and the only thing I had time to do was type out the word arrested and send it to my girlfriend. They ordered me out of the car with, at first, some conflicting instructions, and eventually, you know, I was taken to jail, not before having to see what turned out to be my local police department, who had come to collect me, scream at each other for apparently screwing something up about my arrest, and then having the Johnson County prosecutor's office, the guys who came to get me, they got their handcuffs stuck on me when they were bringing me into booking, so we had to wait about 20 minutes to sort that out. But eventually my girlfriend explained to me, yeah, just what had been alleged there. And a day later, my lawyer showed me the supposed evidence of this. And very quickly, we were able to piece together that there was no way that I had searched this stuff up. And yeah, when I was finally brought to trial, or brought to a hearing about this the next day, the prosecution was forced to rescind their motion to increase my bond. And it was, I don't know, at that point, I was pretty prepared to stay in jail a lot longer, because it was very clear that these people were going to do whatever they could to try and keep me in jail. So about a couple weeks before this had all happened, my bond officer had called me and asked for some clarity about some searches I'd made about scale model kits, which I had been building since being released that second time, and he'd asked for some clarity on what all that was, right? Because he was an older guy and just, I guess, wasn't familiar with this stuff. So I explained that to him, and I also explained that I had been looking up how to repair an old video game, an old, like, handheld Game Boy that I'd had for a long time. And he seemed satisfied with those answers. And then later, yeah, these searches were that one was asking if a Game Boy battery could be used in a trigger device. And the other one was, yeah, something relating to explosives. Basically, it was clear to us that it wasn't me, but My lawyers were the ones that pieced together that it was, in fact, him who had conducted those searches.
Dario, is it accurate that defendants have not received timely court appearances or even been appointed counsel?
Yeah, at the state level, that was a big problem at first. I think it was only after people started, you know, making calls to the county and sort of bugging these people that they finally started getting court-appointed lawyers. And then, yeah, for my case, it has definitely been, they've just been slow-walking this whole thing at every opportunity. I was supposed to have a pretrial motions hearing on the 12th of this month, and a day before, it turned out that the prosecution said, hey, we haven't made any preparations for this, and we need more time.
And also at a systemic level, is it true that defendants were held in really horrible conditions, including isolation? They were subject to invasive and unnecessary strip searches, denied access to lawyers, and had legal notes confiscated. Describe what you're aware of in that regard and what's being done about it.
I definitely shared some of those experiences. My first arrest had me in solitary confinement for about 36 days, and those cells were varying levels of filthy. Mine in particular had mold all over the vent where fresh air came in. And yeah, any time I was taken out for a visit with my lawyer, a visit with family, to go outside for an hour and walk in a circle, I had to be strip searched every time. And pretty much every time, my belongings would be rummaged through and searched. And yeah, I have heard from family members of the other defendants about these other situations. And, you know, it's one of those things where it becomes clear to you that the law binds some people and protects others, to where all we can do is just document these instances and hope that we can bring some accountability at some point in the future.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Heidi Bogosian. My co-host Stephen Rohde and I are speaking with Dario Sanchez, one of the defendants in the Prairie Land case. Dario, what concerns you most about the discrepancies and inconsistencies in the state's narrative of what happened on July 4th?
Yeah, I'll say one of the things that really sticks out to me is just the narrative about this shooting that's alleged to have taken place, right? At first, they said somewhere around, I believe it was 10 shooters were involved, but only 30 shots fired. So, you know, that maths out to every person taking, you know, a couple shots and just suddenly deciding, you know what, never mind. Then changing it to two men, and then one man, and then one person of indeterminate gender. So a lot of this has been really weird and inconsistent, and just the thing that I keep coming back to is just how little sense it all makes.
Now, Daniel Sanchez Estrada has an immigration case pending, but is being held with some of the other defendants at the Federal Medical Center in Fort Worth. What do you know about Daniel's case?
His is also pretty shocking, right? Apparently he was arrested just for moving a box of zines of, you know, political pamphlets between houses. And yeah, another strange thing that happened with him was that he was accidentally released for a time and thankfully was able to spend some time with his family before having to be rearrested and having to turn himself in. Right now, they're still trying to get an immigration lawyer for him because of that pending immigration case. And that's definitely something that's top of mind because of how fast the federal case is moving.
In another instance, after the FBI raided her sister's Fort Worth apartment, Amber Lowry found shattered windows, broken doors, flashbang damage, and abandoned signs of ordinary life. Hermit crabs left behind, work clothes laid out. Her sister, Savannah Batten, had been arrested and labeled a terrorist by federal prosecutors. And we should emphasize the charges in these cases are both federal and state. When the evidence of someone's life suggests they expect to come home, how credible is the government's claim that they intended to commit acts of terrorism?
I would say that that should show us just how ridiculous these claims are, right? Like, yeah, in Savannah's case, I believe it was that she left a frozen cobbler in the microwave that had begun to rot by the time her sister had come to clean up her apartment. And so many other people, like Maricela, she's got children, and so do the Sotos, right? You don't just flip a switch one day and decide, you know what, I'm going to throw away my entire life right here and now, suddenly coordinate an act of terror, right? Because that's the other part of this, that this has all been planned and coordinated. What kind of person plans and coordinates all this and doesn't make any kind of consideration for pets and children that they care for?
Dario, you are going through something horrendous that anyone in America would be horrified by. We know that you're a computer science teacher and caring for your partner, but tell us about what drew you to these protests. Are you politically active? Have you been concerned about what the government's been doing in connection with immigration and other issues? What has motivated you throughout this?
Yeah, in fact, just before this, I was trying to get involved in a local city council election. So I would say I've been pretty active, whether it's voting at every opportunity I have, or I personally don't go out to protest because of just how busy my life was as a teacher and now having to take care of my partner. But I don't know, I guess it all just comes from a place of wanting to improve things around me, whether that's locally or nationally. I don't know, it's something I really hope I'm able to get back to at some point.
The DFW, that's for Dallas-Fort Worth, Support Committee has formed among family, friends, and loved ones of the defendants. It's based locally, but has also been coordinating with people around the country. Tell us more about the kind of support they provide.
It's been a real help to me and my partner because, you know, this has all really been something that's turned our lives around, and having people to help us figure out how to navigate this process has been, it's meant a lot to me. I would say that the biggest thing is just, you know, having something to work toward in between waiting for all this stuff to happen in the courts, right? Being able to try and make people aware of what's going on here.
Dario, one individual says that agents offered money and implied a warrant could disappear in exchange for cooperation. What kinds of allegedly corrupt practices have you observed or heard about?
Yeah, that one was really shocking. I believe that was a child of one of the defendants who that happened to. While I was in Johnson County Jail, I heard all kinds of things about the local officials out there. In fact, one of the things that's been in the news is the sexual harassment case against the sheriff out there. And yeah, while I was in jail, I heard quite a few people talk about how all of this was expected by them, by people that live out there, about how it was only a matter of time that these sort of things came out, and how other officials out there probably have skeletons ready to hop out of their closets too.
Dario, you've said that you didn't regularly go to protests, but has this experience dissuaded you from engaging politically, either in the street or, say, pursuing the city council option?
Not at all. In fact, it's made me realize just how precious all that is to me. In fact, one of the things that I talked about with that previous bond officer who ended up making up that evidence was, he said that, you know, via this ankle monitor, he'd be checking on what I was doing, and that if I was seen around any protests or anything like that, that I'd be in trouble. And it's deeply frustrating to me that my rights have been limited in such a way over such a crazy situation. So I fully intend to, one, win this in court, and two, expand what I've been doing just on a political level because people have threatened to take it away from me.
Dario, your story is remarkable, but apparently not unique in America today. You're an American citizen. All of this has been imposed upon you to silence and restrict your First Amendment activities. I'm learning about your case by doing this interview. I doubt it's gotten the attention that it should around the country. How can listeners follow your case and support what you and your colleagues are doing?
The best way to get up to speed with things is to check out our website, prairielanddefendants.com. That's got information about the case and ways people can get involved. And yeah, I think this is a really important case to pay attention to just because of this attempt to invalidate protest, right? The idea that, you know, one illegal act allegedly happening at a protest suddenly means that everyone is implicated in it. It speaks to where the federal government would like things to go. And I think we really need to be pushing back on this very hard. Yeah, I hope people check it out, get involved. We are certainly trying to make sure that we have adequate legal counsel for all of the defendants, and we're also trying to get some expert witnesses involved as well.
Do you have a trial date, Daria?
Yes. My trial date is currently set at April 20th.
Daria, what you've told us is really chilling and, as you say, points to what the government wants to do vis-a-vis all kinds of protest and free speech across the nation. We'll be following your case, wishing you the best of luck, and thank you so much for sharing the details of what happened.
Yeah, thank you all for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
Is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak about the homeless crisis in New York City and around the country. It's huge. On any one night, 130,000 people are homeless in New York City. 90% of them are black or Latino.
Homelessness is not the fault of the homeless. It's not a moral issue. It's a problem that can be addressed and solved. Give people homes and services if they need them. We'll also look at the bold imperialistic attack when the United States military kidnapped the president of Venezuela and his wife, taking them to New York City on the preposterous charges that they were narco traffickers.
Subjecting Venezuela has been a long time project of the right wing in our country, who want to take their oil and natural resources, control their government, and bring down the government of Cuba as well.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
Being homeless is not a reflection on the inadequacy of a person. It is not a moral issue, even though right-wing figures like Trump's lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, the former mayor of New York City, and Andrew Cuomo, who had hoped to be mayor, maintained that essentially cruel position. They were against giving people subsidized homes and treatment if they required it for health problems, addiction problems, or job training. Homelessness is a consequence of housing affordability, inequality, systemic racism, and pro-capitalist government policies. It is more profitable for the real estate industry to build housing for the rich rather than for the poor. There's more profit in luxury housing.